The great Oz has spoken.
Oh!
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Hello and welcome back to the World of Oz, where we are exploring one of the great films of all time. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Roca. I'm a writer, producer, host, and voiceover artist here in San Diego, California. And we're back for one final part, Steve, to wrap this up, our conversation on one of the greatest films ever made.
But I don't want to leave Oz, John. I'm excited to be here. I don't want to go. In fact, I was so excited that you and I decided to talk about Wicked for Good as an exclusive short for our Patreon and Apple Podcast members. So if you want to hear our review of the modern interpretation of the Land of Oz, the only place to get it is at patreon.com/thecinephiles or by subscribing to our special feed on Apple Podcasts.
You go. Yeah. Another way you can support us as well is if when you're listening to the show and you hear the commercials that come up and you hear Steve and I's dulcet voices telling you about all these products and services, well, if they catch your eye and they catch your interest, please remember to use our code, because when you use our code, you get a huge percentage off that product or service. But also you indicate to our supporters, to these people who are advertising their products and services on our show, that this is a place they spend their ad dollars and get some return for it. So we'd love it if you would do that, if those goods and services appeal to you. So thank you guys for doing that ahead of time.
Absolutely. And since we're, you know, it's so funny having just spoken to with you about Wicked, where we're looking at the story from the perspective of the Wicked Witch of the West and seeing only vaguely the rising threat to her from this little girl from Kansas. And now here we are in the opposite perspective with Dorothy, the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Cowardly Lion all waiting in Oz when who should show up at the Wicked Witch of the West, terrifying all of the citizens of Oz who go running towards the wizard in a blind panic, only to be greeted by the guard, who may or may not be the wizard and may or may not be the same guy that we saw as the doorman, or may or may not drive a carriage in Oz. We don't know, but he is obviously scared too.
This is interesting, because I think watching the movie for the show, it is a fascinating way to watch the film, because I looked at the construction of the movie. And the thing that's really cool about the film is the film builds you to these really high moments where you think everything is going to work out. And then something shows up to stop that. And it's usually the witch or Miss Gulch. I think that's her name when she's out in the regular world. But just when Dorothy's like, oh, I'm back, I'm here, and blah, 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 boom, here comes Miss Gulch to take Toto. Just when Dorothy finds the Scarecrow and the Tin Man and they're about to go off to see the wizard, boom, then she shows up, right? And here's a moment where we're all together and they're getting their hair did and they're about to go and see the wizard and maybe he's going to give them everything that they want, and boom, the witch shows up. So the moment, the editing and the scheduling of the witch showing up throughout the movie, I think is really well done to keep the viewer on their toes and not getting too lost in the fairy tale of it. There is a real threat, and it appears just when you're feeling happy or you're ready to kind of indulge in the happy ever after of the film.
It's all right. Everything is all right. The great and powerful Oz has got matters well in hand. So you can all go home and there's nothing to worry about. Get out of here now. Go on. Go on home and go home.
He is either Oz, pretending to be the guard.
Sure.
Pretending to be scared.
Yeah.
Or he is Oz really scared, pretending to be the guard, and his fear is coming out, or he's a scared guard. And I actually don't know which.
It's a lot of places. Well, it's the magical world of Oz, so it could be all three. I don't know.
That's true.
If you please, sir, we want to see the wizard right away, all four of us.
Orders are, nobody can see the great Oz, not nobody, not know how.
I like the phrase, not nobody, not know how. And by the way, if you pay close attention to the mustache on the guard, you will notice that at times it points up and at times it points down. This could either be the wizard's magic or maybe a continuity error with the makeup department, and I'll let you decide which one it is.
But she's Dorothy.
The witch is Dorothy? Come. Well, that makes a difference. Just wait here. I'll announce you at once.
Why do you think that makes a difference when they're also scared of the witch?
Well, this is what I don't understand. Well, and this is the thing. There are movies that are supposed to make sense. And this movie, you know, it was really funny. In our review of Wicked, one of the things we discussed was how well does part two deal with Dorothy and the story. And the thing that we kind of bumped up against was to some degree, it's very hard to make it make sense.
Yes.
Well, part of why it's hard to make it make sense is that this doesn't 100% make sense.
Yeah.
Because he saw the ruby, if he is the wizard, he saw the ruby slippers at the gate, which means he wants them.
Right.
So he already knows that. And now he's found out that this is Dorothy, and it's either that he wants to see Dorothy or he doesn't want to see Dorothy. And this guard goes back and forth, which is why this doesn't really make sense to me of whether or not this is or is not the wizard.
Did you hear that? He'll announce us at once. I've as good as got my brain.
I can barely hear my heart beating.
I'll be home in time for supper.
In another hour, I'll be king of the forest. Long live the king.
And we go into If I Were King of the Forest.
Yeah.
If I were king of the forest.
One of my favorite songs from the whole thing. And as you said, Steve, one of the ones that gets cut in some iterations of the movie, which is a shame. I wonder if this is the one that got cut for the Sphere version of the movie, which is cut down as well in Vegas. But I love this. And the way he sings it, forest. And it's a sweet little song about the possibilities of what he thinks his life will be if he gets this thing that he's supposedly missing, right? It is a fantastical approach to it all. And you really see them come together around the song, all four of them, right? And I think that's a sweet way of like seeing them just before they're about to put them through some hell and separate them as well when the flying monkeys take Dorothy.
It's so interesting because not only is this a full song, like all the, we've been talking about the fact that a lot of these are snippets, you know, that you get, you know, Follow the Yellow Brick Road. It's not really a full song. Like Somewhere Over the Rainbow is a full song. The If I Only Had a Heart, If I Only Had a Brain, they're like about a half a song each, you know, and things like We're Off to See the Wizard and stuff like that. They're just little pieces of a song.
Right.
But this is a full song.
Yeah.
It's also the last song in the musical.
Oh.
Which is really strange to have a musical where the last song is like 35 minutes before the end of the film.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah.
Now, there are other songs that were later cut, and that's part of why this is the last song. I also agree with you. They are all a family now. They have all come together. And I also think the idea, If I Were King of the Forest, it so perfectly tracks the fantasy life of a child, you know?
Yeah, right.
Like it's how this is how, if only I could have this, then I would be this and everybody would come to me. And man, Bert Lahr, what he does with this song, he literally makes a meal out of it.
As I click my heel, all the trees would kneel and the mountains bow and the bulls kowtow. And the sparrow would take wing. Fie, well, king.
Even the changes in tone, right? When he says, the chipmunks genuflect to me. There's that little, like, shifts in how he's singing the song that make it very endearing.
Well, and it, you know, it's that same thing too, that he's having fun playing with language because you have rhymes that don't quite work, like my tail would lash, I would show compassion.
Yes.
You know, but Bert Lahr makes all that really fun. And I like the way they stage it too, that you have these little visual treats, like, you know, have these three green columns that are supporting these vases, except they grab one of the columns and it ends up being a rug that they unroll, you know, and then that rug that they unroll becomes his cape, and then with a huge train, and then the, you know, they pick up one of these urns and the Tin Man breaks it, and that is his crown.
Yeah,
you know, like it is literally delightful.
The thing you brought up here just a few seconds ago, playing with language, right?
Not even a rhinoceros?
Imposterous.
How about a hippopotamus?
Why, I'd thrash him from top to bottom.
Supposing you met an elephant?
I'd wrap him up in cellophane.
So those three interactions are really funny. And If you remember Flight of the Conchords, there's a great song in Flight of the Conchords, which was when those two guys try to do a rap, and one is called the Rhymenoceros, and the other one is called the Hip-Hop-Hippopotamus. And so I have to believe that the playing with words here in this song might have influenced these guys to come up with that kind of version of playing with this song and making, or playing those words and making them connect to some rap terms. So I thought that, I couldn't help but think that as I was watching the song this time around.
I am sure it's a connection. And that's why I say, like just the rhyme on Genuflect. There's a, like I said, Tom Lehrer, I'm sure, was inspired by this. And he has his, maybe his best song, which is the Vatican Rag, has a great rhyme for Genuflect in it. But you know what it is? I am actually putting my finger on something else here. This influenced all of us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Probably, like saying, like, I can tell you how Frank Miller comic books in the 80s influenced my writing, or how Edward Albee, when I started writing plays, like that's what I can tell. I can track all sorts of different things that influenced me at different times in my life.
Right.
I can't track that The Wizard of Oz influenced me, but of course it did. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, I kind of going like, oh, all of us, every single one of us got influenced by this because we all watched it.
The wizard says go away.
Again, just as we're going on this high, here comes something in the construction of a movie to smack us all the way back down again. And it's the guard, the guy who was like, oh, well, why didn't you say so? I'll announce you right away. No problem. And then right after the song, get out of here.
Well, and this is why, you know, we had our short recently on Headcanon on Patreon. And this is why in my headcanon, this is not the wizard. This is the guard.
Oh, okay.
That he is playing multiple parts. Because to me, it doesn't make sense that he's pretending to be the wizard, finds out she's Dorothy, knows he has the shoes, says, I'll let you right in, then spends a minute thinking about it, then comes out and says, go away. And then, like, and then gets really, really sad, which is about to happen, and then lets them in, and then is planning to send Dorothy off to her death. Like, no, like this, there's just too many contradictions if these are all the same person. So in my headcanon, it is different characters.
Fair enough.
And they're just wrecked.
I mean,
Dorothy is crying. Her friends are comforting them. The guard is watching this whole thing. And now, man, she's getting into the full level of guilt because she goes,
Annie, Em was so good to me. And I never appreciated it. Running away and hurting her feelings. Professor Marvel said she was sick. She may be dying. And it's all my fault.
Cut to ridiculous crying from the guard.
Please don't cry anymore. I'll get you into the wizard somehow. I had an aunt him myself once.
The door opens, he's gone, and they start going down the long, dark, scary hallway.
Yeah. So here's headcanon time. I think he got scared and said, no, you're not going. And then she started crying. That did affect him. And now he disappears after they walk in. And they're walking as long, which gives him ample time to run behind the curtain. But who knows? Who knows?
I mean, I am perfectly comfortable with your headcanon. And I think, well, and again, I don't think this movie really makes sense. So neither of our headcanon is going to make this actually work out perfectly. But that's, you know what I was thinking about is like when you're a kid in particular, you watch a lot of things that don't make sense.
No.
You know, like they're silly and goofy and fun. And there's a thing about a certain kind, particularly like, you know, theater, children's theater, where we all know this is a show. Part of it, the fun, of course it doesn't make sense, is we're being silly. We're playing, you know, this is playful. It's not critical that everything, you know, in Citizen Kane, it all makes sense.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of ambiguity and things to speculate about. But this kind of movie, that's not the requirement, you know?
No.
That's not what we're trying to do, you know?
Yeah. And even with the serious stuff, you have to kind of, you know, let the air out a little bit. And those humorous scenes do that.
Wait a minute, fellas. I was just thinking, I really don't want to see the wizard this much. I better wait for you outside.
Who just sang about courage.
Yeah,
saying he doesn't want to go in.
And I think when they link arms, it very much reminds me of Lions and Tigers and Bears, you know?
Yeah.
It's that same kind of, we're really scared and we're all sticking together.
Great message.
By the way, in the book, they each go to see Oz separately.
Oh.
And Oz appears to them So he does appear as the big head, but he also appears as a ball of fire, and he also appears as other things that I don't remember. Hi, Cinephiles fans. You know, sometimes when I'm prepping for a show, I get an undeniable urge for something sweet. And lately, my go-to has been Washington Red Raspberries. Now, if you've been listening to this show, you already know that Washington Red Raspberries are frozen at the peak of freshness by passionate farmers in Washington State. But what you might not know is how to make a delicious mini crumble in under 15 minutes. So here's my shoot from the hip recipe. Grab a couple of handfuls of frozen raspberries and throw them in the microwave just long enough to get them warm. Probably less than a minute. Toss in a few tablespoons of sugar, a squeeze of lemon juice, and a bit of cornstarch. Give it a taste and adjust the sweetness. In a separate bowl, mash together some oats, flour, butter, brown sugar, cinnamon, and a pinch of salt. I'd give that a taste too, but all combos of butter and carbs and sugar are going to taste pretty good. Spread that on top of your berries in a container that can stand up to air fryer temperatures. I have a tiny cast iron skillet that works perfectly. Then throw the whole thing in your air fryer at 400 degrees, and between 6 and 10 minutes later, you will have a beautiful raspberry crumble that can only be improved by a scoop of vanilla ice cream. Now, Washington Red Raspberries have been specially developed to be frozen, which means they can survive freezing and microwaving, air frying, and still maintain great texture, color, and flavor. And I can confirm that they are particularly delicious when eaten while watching a great film. Washington Red Raspberries are available in the freezer section at places like Costco, Kroger, and Winco Foods. Make sure to look for Product of the U.S. on the bag, and happy cooking.
Hey, Cinephiles fans, the holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. You know, right now it's Oscar season with all these films coming out that are vying for nominations next year, and I went to the Uncommon Goods website, and they have this incredible book that you can give as a gift. It's called The History of the Oscars. From the LA Times here, it features 250 plus pages of original Oscar coverage from 1929 to the present, and you can personalize it with a name on the cover and a heartfelt message inside at no extra cost for that film lover on your list. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, though, and with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/cinephiles. That's uncommongoods.com/CINEFILES for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. So, Steve, it looks like we have a new sponsor on the Cinephiles, and I understand you've gotten some good use out of them.
Dude, since we've been working with Secret Nature, my sleep's been better, my stress level is down, and I've been more productive.
Wow, that sounds like a major change knowing you.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, between the podcast, being a dad, and the world,
yeah.
I wasn't exactly in top form. But when I tried the Secret Nature Daytime Gummy, I got like a clean, cool feeling. I mean, I could feel my shoulders literally dropping down a couple of inches, and I was able to stop focusing on a whole bunch of things I couldn't control and sit down to deal with some of the things I could.
That's fantastic. I know a lot of people would love to feel this way. And your sleep is better too?
Oh yeah. I used to wake up all the time and not be able to get back to sleep. But Secret Nature has a great nighttime gummy that not only helps me sleep through the night, but I am waking up refreshed and focused.
That's great, brother. I love that. And if you all want to try Secret Nature gummies, you can get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code CINEFILES. That's secretnature.com. Code CINEFILES. Try them out today.
I think this set, when we go into the Oz set, is astounding. Agreed. And that big head with looks like Frank Morgan, amazing.
That big head is better than the big head in the Wicked film.
I like the big head in the Wicked film. Like the sort of steampunky mechanicalness to it. But I don't think it can beat this. I actually, you know what? I do like the head in the Wicked film, but I'm agreeing with you. This one is better. It's genuinely scary.
Yeah.
And may I pause for a moment in this story to tell you an extremely cute story about my childhood.
Okay.
So it won't be surprising to anyone to learn that I, as a very little kid, or really as an adult kid, an old kid or an adult, had a very vivid imagination. Hmm. And lacking, you know, screens and things like that, I just spent a lot of time imagining things, including sitting in my closet for hours and hours in a land I called the Land of the Bleeblahs. I was about four or five years old. Mm. And every once in a while, other people would come visit the land of the Bliblaws, and they each had their name. And the ruler of the land of the Bliblaws was, in fact, my father, who was an optometrist and was therefore known as the Wizard of Eyes. So my dad was the Wizard of Eyes and would sit in a closet with me.
Wow.
And I would, you know, make up stories about the Bliblaws.
That's great.
Adorable, yes or no?
You decide. Let us
know. You decide, cinephiles.
If you please, I am Dorothy, the small and meek. We've come to ask you.
Silence! The great and powerful Oz knows why you have come.
Well, why did you ask who they were a second ago?
Exactly.
You dare to come to me for a heart, do you? You clinking, clanking, clattering collection of collisionous junk.
Great lines.
Great. I love this stuff.
And you, Scarecrow, have the effrontery to ask for a brain. You billowing bale of bovine fodder.
Same thing. Scarecrow tries to respond. He shuts him down. And you, lion. And they push him forward and he just faints.
So good.
Well, and what's so great about it, too, is it triggers this thing that we've seen several times before, which is when the lion threatened Toto.
Yeah.
Dorothy is all over it. And right. Now the Oz, she doesn't care. Oz scared one of her friends.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She will stand up to anybody. This is what makes Dorothy a great hero.
You ought to be ashamed of yourself, frightening him like that when he came to you for help.
Silence, whippersnapper. The beneficent Oz has every intention of granting your requests.
I love the line wakes up like, huh? What?
First, you must prove yourselves worthy by performing a very small task. Bring me the broomstick of the Witch of the West.
So I think the choice to come up with the story of Wicked is brilliant. And mm-hmm. This moment is why.
Yeah.
Because, so regardless of whether or not he is or is not the guard, this young girl shows up.
Yeah.
And this complete fraud
yeah.
says, go kill the most dangerous person in our world.
Right.
See you later, child.
Get rid of her. Yeah,
get exactly. I mean, it is truly an evil thing to do without question.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Especially because he asks it after he's insulted all of them.
Yeah. Right?
With these very good and inventive, for those of you who watch Drag Race, he pretty much read them all, you know, and it's great. And it's great dialogue, great lines. And then says, oh, I'll grant it to you. So it's like, he's like beating them down and then says, oh, I'll give you what you want, but you got to go do this. So he's taken away their self-esteem in a way. So they become more manipulatable. I hope that's a word to be able to get them to do this task. As you said, that it's pretty much an evil task. You know,
it's terrible. Yeah. I mean, it's just, what's so crazy about it. And this just shows, it's one of all those lessons of like why the way I think about stories, which I still think are right,
yeah,
are frequently wrong, you know, because right. like I'm always bothered in the superhero trope where that we have to team up with the bad guy and now the bad guy is kind of becoming a good guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's like there are times where like with Loki, I think that works really well because right. he's such a great character. But there are other times like Baron Zemo and stuff like that. And, you know, if you watch any of those WB superheroes where it's like, oh, now the bad guy is the good guy. Oh, now the good guy is the bad guy. Oh, now the bad guy is the good guy again. Oh, now you're in love with the bad guy. And it's just like, oh my God, this is terrible. But clearly in The Wizard of Oz, it 100% works.
Yeah.
Because despite this moment where this complete fraud sends a little girl to her death, we totally like the guy.
Yeah.
A couple of scenes from now.
Because it worked out.
We certainly wouldn't
like it if she died, you know? Yeah.
Well, then Oz just keeps ruling Oz, you know, except that he probably gets killed by the witch who's gotten the ruby slippers and is now even more powerful.
Right.
But they pick up pretty quick what he's asking to do.
But if we do that, we'll have to kill her to get it.
Bring me her broomstick and I'll grant your requests. Now go.
But what if she kills this fight?
I said go!
I love the shot of the Cowardly Lion running down that hallway just in total terror.
It's very vaudevillian. There are things you remember from your childhood. And the thing I remember the most from my... One of the things I remember really distinctly from my childhood is whenever I watched this on TV, this was the moment they went to a commercial break. As soon as the lion dives out the window in the glass, and you hear the glass, because he runs with such fear, it goes right to commercial. And every time I've watched the movie as an adult, I always remember, oh, this is where we go to commercial. You know, because it's such a button on that scene, him jumping out the window.
There's so many formative experiences of our childhood that current generations are not experiencing.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
You know?
Concept of, yeah.
We cut to the witch's domain. There's like, it's creepy old woods, haunted forest. We see a sign that says, Haunted Forest, Witch's Castle, 1 mile. I'd turn back if I were you. They walk up to the sign, and for no reason that we can ever understand, and it is never explained or ever returned to again, they are carrying a giant butterfly net, a big hammer that says witch remover, and a gun. And the Tin Man has a huge wrench.
Yeah.
And never mentioned again. We never see them again. But it's weird. The witch is watching them approach in the crystal ball, gives instructions to her winged monkeys to bring her Dorothy. And then she has this line where she says,
"They'll give you no trouble, I promise you that. I've sent a little insect on ahead to take the fight out of them."
And we might wonder, what the hell is this insect she's talking about? And that is because there is a whole musical number called The Jitterbug, where they were attacked by insects that has been cut.
But they kept the line?
But they kept the line.
Weird. Okay.
Well, it might very well depend on how they cover the scene, because if they cover the shot, if it's really a oneer and they don't have any coverage, it might be really hard to cut that line out.
Good point.
This is, by the way, the classic debate between cinematographers who tend to want to shoot things all in one shot. They don't want their beautiful footage cut up, and editors who want all the coverage possible. It's like, if you shot a close-up of everybody in that scene, I can cut out any line you want.
That's true.
If you don't give me the coverage I need, I cannot cut out that line. And now we have a ton of flying monkeys flying through these sets. These are mostly like local jockeys. Like they went to Santa Anita and said, "Hey, you guys want to be flying monkeys?" There are a couple of munchkins that are also flying monkeys. And this is really, when you see a whole bunch of them flying in and out and grabbing Dorothy and grabbing the dog and attacking the other people, this is an unbelievably complicated wire work sequence.
It's kind of scary.
Genuinely scary.
Yeah.
And if you go to the studio, the soundstage in Culver City where this was shot, which is still standing, the tracks for the monkeys' ropes are all still up on the ceiling.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that cool?
That is cool.
They've grabbed Dorothy and Toto. Scarecrow is helpless because his guts have all been ripped out. What
happened to you? They tore my legs off and they threw them over there. Then they took my chest out and they threw it over there.
Well, that's you all over.
Now, that's a good vaudeville joke right there.
It is.
What a nice little dog.
And she puts the dog in the same basic basket that Elmira Gulch had.
Yes.
Oh, please give me back my dog.
Certainly, certainly. When you give me those slippers.
But the good witch of the north told me not to.
Very well. Throw that basket in the river and drown him.
This is messed up, man.
Yeah. It gets real dark here.
And so she agrees to give her the slippers, and she reaches for them and gets shocked.
Her screams when she gets shocked are so good. Like, you legitimately are like, oh, shit. Like, you know, because we've seen her so powerful throughout the whole movie. In this one moment, you see that there is something that can make her scared.
Well, speaking of scared, we're about to get little Steve scared because you talk about getting dark.
Those slippers will never come off as long as you're alive. But that's not what's worrying me. It's how to do it. These things must be done delicately.
She's amazing. And did you notice in The New Wicked, in Wicked for Good, there's a moment, I think it's Madame Marble says, delicately, totally referencing that tone. Her performance is so great. But in the midst of this, Toto escapes.
Run, Toto, run!
Catch him, Harry!
And Toto runs down the stairs, being chased by the Winkies. He runs up the drawbridge as it rises, jumps across the moat. They're throwing spears at him. It's a full-on action sequence. So, you know, we've mentioned there have been some injuries on the set. Obviously, Buddy Epson and his lungs, the witch, you know, the witch's stand-in. There's been a lot of things that happened. Toto was also injured. In this sequence, one of the guards, the Winkies, stepped on him.
Oh, my God.
And he had to there was a stunt Toto for several days while he was recovering.
I mean, the poor Toto, yeah.
And now the witch is mad, and she grabs an hourglass.
You see that? That's how much longer you've got to be alive. And it isn't long, my pretty. It isn't long. I can't wait forever to get those shoes.
This scared the crap out of me.
Why? Can you specify? Can you?
Yes, trapped in a room with your imminent death. I mean, it's a very, like, you're sitting in a room, you can't leave, and you're watching the sands go through the hourglass, and when the last sand goes, you die. I think that is a very powerful notion that sunk its claws deep into my very imaginative 5-year-old brain. You know, I mean, honestly, you know what I think? All humans have some degrees of empathy, or maybe they're, I shouldn't say that. Maybe there's some that don't, but most humans do. And most humans, particularly when you're seeing a story, live the feelings of the people in the story that you're watching.
Right.
I think that artists, storytellers, actors, I think they live those experiences maybe stronger than other people. I think because what is being a writer? What is being an actor? It is going, how would I feel if that happened to me? What would I do? Putting yourself in that place, you know?
Yeah. I suppose you're right. I don't know how we can quantify it, because I think there are, you know, because the reason these things endure is because
absolutely
people who aren't actors or creatives or whatever still feel them in their bones in their daily lives. So, yeah, but feeling them deeper, I think you're onto something there for sure.
Dorothy is crying. She sits down next to that, you know, the big crystal ball.
Yeah.
Weeping.
I'm frightened, Auntie Em. I'm frightened.
Auntie Em appears in the ball.
Dorothy.
This is so cruel.
Do you think the witch brought that image on purpose?
1,000,000%.
Okay.
Yes.
It's me. It's Auntie Em. We're trying to find you. Where are you?
And she's crying out to her aunt. This is in her desperation.
I'm here in Oz, Auntie Em. I'm locked up in the witch's castle. And I'm trying to get home to you, Auntie Em.
And then Auntie Em disappears. And the witch appears in the crystal ball.
Auntie Em, come back! I'll give you Auntie Em, my pretty.
And the witch in the crystal ball turns towards camera.
Yeah.
And laughs directly at us.
Yep. Yeah.
I think this is one of the most amazing moments in any movie. It's amazing.
I agree. To me, this is what they call a wrestling heel promo. Like, it's what it is. Like, Dorothy, by the way, this is some great acting from Judy Garland in this scene. Just, like, Dorothy is so distraught and reaching out for the one person who she has been beating herself up out of guilt for through the whole movie that she didn't appreciate. Never mind that they were kind of just putting up with her bratty butt in the first section. But in her mind, she has a whole new appreciation for Auntie Em. And to see Auntie Em there, by the way, I mean, how would she see Auntie Em? It's because it's the witch's magic there. So maybe she does. Maybe that is Auntie Em, right? Maybe that is Auntie Em, but the witch is in control. So she lets Dorothy be tortured by the fact that Auntie Em can't hear her, but she can see her and is screaming out for her through the crystal ball. And then she appears. It's such a great twist. And then she mocks her and mocks us and laughs right at us. That's a great heel promo. The Rock used to, when he was a heel, The Rock would say all this kind of stuff away from the camera, and you were just transfixed because he's so charming and interesting and fun. But when he was going to deliver the heel point, he looked right at the camera with the eyebrow arched and he said his line. He's like, oh, shit. You know, so this is what the witch essentially does in this moment. She's gone full heel in this moment, you know, because she just wants the slippers. But for whatever reasons and her sister's dead. So you might feel little sympathy, right? But the second she torches Dorothy like this and looks at the camera, she's gone full heel, you know?
I love that explanation of the thing. And I just the level of torture, of cruelty to do this. Dorothy's going to be dead in like 5 minutes anyway.
Right.
To like go, but I want to make you suffer just a little bit more before you die.
One more shot at you.
Toto runs down through the forest to find our friends. And we have a classic sort of Lassie moment where they realize what Toto's trying to tell them. They go back up the cliff, approach the castle.
Dorothy's in that awful place.
Oh, I hate to think of her in there. We've got to get her out.
Don't cry now. We haven't got the oil can with us, and you've been squeaking enough as it is.
I have the great chemistry between them. And also, it's the Tin Man who's constantly crying for all this conversation about the Cowardly Lion. It's the Tin Man who's crying at every turn, you know.
Well, but he's crying because he feels sad for Dorothy, not because he's scared.
That's what I'm saying, but he has a heart.
So, like, of course he has a heart.
Yeah.
Up come the Winkies with another song fragment, which I don't know about you, but as a young person, I heard multiple definitions of what they are saying as they go, Did you hear one of those?
No, I only ever heard it as oh we oh oh. That's all I ever heard when they were doing it.
In those heady days before the internet, someone would come up to you and say, "Hey man, you know when those guards come up at the Wicked Witch's castle? What they're actually saying is all we own, we owe."
Oh wow!
And then later on, I heard we loathe the old one. There's a whole bunch of these. And of course, none of them are true. They're just saying, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Didn't this influence
the song in the animated Lord of the Rings for the orcs? Like,
I hadn't thought about that, but it's funny that you mentioned that. I can totally hear what you're saying. What I was going to say a moment later is that when they are, you know, hiding, looking as the Winkies are coming up, it is so damn similar to both in The Lord of the Rings when Frodo, Gollum, and Sam are at the Black Gates.
Yeah.
It's staged almost exactly the same way. Right. And I also just rewatched The Princess Bride, and it's totally staged right like with the Dread Pirate Roberts where they're hiding in the thing. You know, like I think this moment, and I don't know if those filmmakers were consciously thinking about this, but this is actually, to me, what I mean by we were all influenced by this.
Yeah, yeah. Because like in the animated version of The Lord of the Rings, you hear the orcs going, well, there's a whip, whoops, there's a way. And that, to me, feels very similar to the it has that energy to it. So, yeah.
Two things happen. One, as you already said, the Tin Man obviously has a heart because he's obviously being very emotional. Yeah. And the Scarecrow obviously has a brain because, once again, he's the guy who comes up with the plan.
All right. I'll go in there for Dorothy.
I may not come out alive, but I'm going in there.
There's only one thing I want you fellas to do.
What's that?
Talk me out of it.
But the thing is, he is going in there.
Yep.
Because, I mean, what's so great about the Cowardly Lion in particular, he does have courage when it's for somebody else.
Right. Yes.
When it's for doing the right thing, for protecting someone he loves, he has all the courage he needs.
Great point.
That hourglass is getting low and they're starting to move closer to the guards. And then we see a bunch of bad guys just pop up right behind them.
Yeah.
And it's a very funny little bit. And I like they drop below the rocks and we see like the detritus and the tail and stuff popping up behind the rocks. And then later, the Tin Man, the Scarecrow, and the Lion pop up all dressed in disguise.
So great. I love the Tin Man in his outfit. He almost looked Russian in his outfit with the tin face. It's weird.
You know what other moment? And it's a trope. So I'm not saying it was referencing this, but Raiders of the Lost Ark, when Harrison Ford knocks out the guard and then gets it. But there they play with it because the uniform doesn't fit.
Yeah. You know?
And the music builds as they come down the hill, join in with the marchers. I love the lion's tail that is moving out of control behind as they marched. And of course, this is old school technology. Want to know how they did the tail?
Go ahead.
There's a dude with a wire who's in the rafters who's falling along and pulling the tail up and down as he walks.
So good.
The music, by the way, is totally Night on Bald Mountain by Mussorgsky, which is at the end of, it's in the Ave Maria sequence in Fantasia. The other piece of music is Night on Bald Mountain. They're totally referencing it here. They get to the door where Dorothy is, who calls out to them.
It's me! She's locked me in!
Listen, fellas, we gotta get her out. Open the door.
Oh, hurry, please, hurry!
The axe hits the door. She comes out, embraces them, embracing Toto. They run down the stairs as fast as they can. The music is great, and just as you think they're about to escape, those big doors close.
Going so soon? I wouldn't hear of it. Why, my little party's just beginning.
And the guards are advancing, and as they advance, the Scarecrow looks around, looks at the ropes, looks up at the chandelier, and just as the witch throws the hourglass down at them, which explodes, the Scarecrow, who again is the smartest person and has a brain, grabs the axe, chops the rope, dropping the chandelier on the guards. They all run, and we get a really nice chase scene going around the corner, up the stairs, witches and guards, you know, searching for them. And then we end up on a new set, which is the rooftop of the castle.
Oh, yeah.
Which looks, I mean, this, it's a beautifully designed set combined with those incredible matte paintings. And frankly, at this moment, MGM's the biggest studio in Hollywood, which makes it the biggest studio in the world. They have the best technicians anywhere. The matte painting department is the best in the world. And the thing you have to understand about how movies were made at this time is that everything is made by hand.
Right.
And so this is like, I picture like Michelangelo with his huge team of people painting the Sistine Chapel. Like, that's what they have to do to create these matte paintings. Yeah. Is you have this team that is working on every big movie coming through MGM like a factory. I don't know how many people are in this department, but these are the best of the best working at this time to make a set like this.
Yeah, you know? It's amazing. Yeah. And what's amazing, just like with 2001, like, the sets still endure. The gorgeous and beautifulness of the sets still endure. Yeah.
I mean, I remember when we did Modern Times and there's the sequence where he's roller skating and he's roller skating backwards and it keeps looking like he's going to fall off this balcony, which is really just an unbelievably well-designed matte painting that's framed into the thing to make the shot work. But it's like, you look at that in the, you know, that's like 6 years before this movie.
Yep.
And it looks perfect, you know, because great art is great art. But they've trapped them, backed them up, and of course they back up right towards the bucket. So we see that in the shot.
Got to be pretty foxy, didn't you? Well, the last to go will see the first three go before her.
The last to go will see the first three go before her. That means I'm going to kill all those people, including your dog, and make you watch.
Yeah. It's brutal.
It's brutal.
Yeah.
And she lifts up her broom to the torch and lights it and says,
"How about a little fire, Scarecrow?"
So Margaret Hamilton has a flaming broom in her hand. And they have asked her to light the Scarecrow on fire.
Yeah.
This is a real problem. So first of all, she was already severely injured, second and third degree burns by fire early in the shoot. I am not certain whether or not this was shot before or after she refused to be on the broom when they did the fire explosion where they ended up putting the stand-in on it, who also went to the hospital.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this was before or after, but she really didn't want to do this. She was, because it wasn't just that they wanted her to hold a broom that was on fire. Yeah. They had wrapped the Scarecrow in fire retardant fabric because they literally said, "We want you to light Ray Bolger's arm on fire."
Oof.
And she's having a real hard time.
I'm sure. Because she's another human being, and it's probably someone she's become friends with and probably a performer she's seen quite a few times, you know? And so the idea of lighting him on fire, considering what she's experienced, probably not something she was jumping to do.
I mean, we talk a lot about all the ways that it's today actors are more respected and protected, both in terms of physical safety and for emotional trauma, for all these reasons.
Right.
This is why, you know, because at this time, you know, she's not a wealthy person. She's a small actor working on a studio contract. And when they say jump, you jump.
Yeah.
This is her whole career. And they're going, you have to do this shot. It takes her 9 takes. The one she finally managed to light his arm on fire, she fainted dead away.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And that's why I don't know if this is before or after she refused to do the one on the broom. Yeah. My guess is this was probably before, and this is why she refused finally to do it on the broom. But I don't know. I don't know that at all. So she lights his arm on fire, and Dorothy grabs a bucket of water to put out the scarecrow.
Right.
Which is
the witch, right?
Not to throw on the witch, which is when we get to Wicked, this is maybe slightly different.
Yeah.
And she throws the water on the witch, who goes,
ah, you cursed rat! Look what you've done! I'm melting! Melting! Oh, what a world! What a world! Who would have thought a good little girl like you could destroy my beautiful wickedness? Ah, the mouth! The mouth!
That's quite a mouthful as you're dying. That's quite a mouthful.
I love it. It's my beautiful wickedness. It's like an amazing line. Visually, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And basically all it is, you know, again, old school stuff is we got, you know, steam coming up, you know, which is probably from dry ice. We've got her on a trap door being lowered down. They have fans coming from underneath to send the air, you know, up. Originally, by the way, the fans were on so strong that they blew her entire dress up over her head, which obviously is not what you want. So what they had to do is then they basically stapled her dress down around the trap door. So when the air is coming up, it makes that sort of cone that makes it look like she's sort of melting into the it works really, really well.
It does. Yeah.
And then she's gone.
Yeah.
Toto pause at the close.
Wait. Don't run past this. Do you remember when this moment happened for you the first time as a child, what your reaction was to her death being like so quick out of the water? Surprising too.
So obviously I absolutely don't remember the first time because I was probably 6 months old or something, but I remember, I'm glad you asked this question because I'm kind of trying to sort out like what I really felt about it at the time. I think it had that mix of being both freaky.
Yeah.
And triumphant. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that. What do you think your reaction was?
I'm pretty sure I was shocked at her death because, as you said, she wasn't trying to kill her. And the fact that it was water, something as simple as water, which of course has been something from War of the Worlds to other stories where people have been like, water? You know, because there's symbolism to water, which is why it is the washing away of things. And so I was just surprised. I remember being shocked that's how it happened. Because it looked like they were dead. I mean, they were definitely, she was going to take care of them and kill all the Mantoto. So to have it come just out of the blue from an accident that Dorothy was trying to put out the flames on the scarecrow, I think there was just a moment of shock for me watching it and watching her death. I'm sure my mouth was like wide open, like shocked at it all.
Well, and because she's so powerful.
Yeah.
And she gets taken out so fast and so unexpectedly. In fact, it's so unexpected that the Winky guard turns and says,
"She's dead. You've killed her."
What I like about this moment is I feel the way that this actor delivers this line is perfectly neutral to the point where Dorothy can't know if this guard liked the witch in the first moment. Yeah. It's like, wait, is this a good thing or a bad thing?
I didn't mean to kill her. Really, I didn't. It's just that he was on fire.
Hail to Dorothy! The Wicked Witch is dead!
Hail to Dorothy! The Wicked Witch is dead!
Which, by the way, Dorothy, this little girl, has killed two humans, or two witches, you know? Wow! She's going to have a lot to talk about in therapy, I think.
Well, and they kneel to her. And what's also interesting is that Dorothy is apologizing for it because she's a good person. And it wasn't her intention. She didn't drop the house on the witch, and she didn't throw the water on the witch on purpose. So she's trying to apologize to everybody because she doesn't want to be any trouble. So it's an element of what she's been feeling guilty about through the whole time she's been there, you know? And so it's a great response. And it's just shocking that they don't beat her up, but instead thank her because they were probably under the control of the witch.
So we have a question from another patron, Peter Bylone, who was a cadet at West Point. Ooh, and there are all sorts of West Point connections, or perceived connections is what I should actually say, to the Wizard of Oz, which is when he was there, there's the mansion across the Hudson, which was commonly referred to as Castle Rock. He was at West Point, and there was a rumor that that's where they shot the castle scenes for the Wicked Witch in the Wizard of Oz.
Oh, wow.
which, Peter, they absolutely did not. It was all shot on sets in Culver City. So that one's not true. And then there was also, when they looked at the Winkies and the Winged Monkeys in their costuming, they said, this looks like cadets from West Point. And there's also, because L. Frank Baum was at a cadet at the Peekskill Military Academy, which was near West Point. And there's some rumor that he never really liked cadets from West Point. I don't think there's any truth in this rumor anywhere that I could find. And that therefore that was part of why the idea of coming up with putting the Winged Monkeys in outfits that look like West Point cadets. None of this is actually true. So sorry, folks that are in cadets at West Point. There any rumors that are going around, as far as I was able to tell, there are no actual connections to the costumes or the designs in Wizard of Oz to West Point. Sorry.
Okay, there you go. It's been debunked. There you go.
The broom. May we have it?
Please, and take it with you.
Oh, thank you so much. Now we can go back to the wizard and tell him the Wicked Witch is dead.
And then, had we had the original version of this movie, we would have gone into a big triumphant musical number.
Mm.
But they cut it for time.
Oh.
So what their solution is rather than, because what it was, I think there was a musical number with the Winkies that goes into a musical number at Oz when they return to Oz that leads to them going up to the wizard, and they just went, skip the whole thing. We're just going to dissolve right back to Oz, and that's it.
Wow. Okay.
and you know what? You can't argue with success, but this is what, you're always the one who always wants to see the deleted scenes and watch the longer.
Yeah.
And this is one where I definitely do. I would like to see the Ray Bolger dance number, this and even the Jitterbug one, you know.
Why have you come back?
Please, sir, we've done what you told us. We brought you the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West. We melted her.
Oh, you liquidated her, eh? Very resourceful.
Yes, sir.
Did Oz know that she could be killed by water?
I guess, since he said that.
You know? I don't think so. He's a con man. I think he just is rolling with new info.
Okay.
So we'd like you to keep your promise to us, if you please, sir.
Not so fast. Not so fast. I'll have to give the matter a little thought.
The reason he has to give them some thought is because he actually sent them to die.
Right. He didn't anticipate they would come back and come back this quickly.
By the way, there's so much flames in this set that it just kept catching on fire.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I think I told you that they had stationed a fire department specifically because there's so much light on these sets. Yeah. This was a dangerous movie to be working on.
You've had plenty of time already.
Yeah. Do not arouse the wrath of the great and powerful Oz.
Toto runs over to this curtain in the side of the set.
If you were really great and powerful, you'd keep your promises.
Do you presume to criticize the great Oz?
And as he's saying this, Toto is pulling back the curtain, and the Scarecrow is the first one to notice it. And one of the nice subtle things I think they do is that you've been hearing Oz in this booming voice.
Yeah.
And the moment that you see the man behind the curtain, they change the mix on the voice. So you're still hearing a good portion of the big booming Oz, but you're also hearing the normal voice, and his performance shifts suddenly from full on Oz to pretending to be Oz. You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
You ungrateful creatures, think yourselves lucky that I'm giving you audience tomorrow instead of 20 years from now.
And then he realizes that they're looking at him.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
I've used that line so many times in my life. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Yeah.
I think that line says a lot about life.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah. The film is making a commentary. I know some of you hate commentaries in movies. Some of you think there is no commentaries in classic movies. There's absolutely commentary in your movies. And there is a commentary here about, you know, people in charge who portray themselves as one thing, but they're actually utter buffoons behind the scenes, whether it's government or religion or what, or your own boss at your job. There is that coursing throughout this movie, is that the people in charge convey a certain power, but in fact, they're really small people behind the scenes. And so I like that that element is here. I like that it's Toto, something sweet and instinctual with an instinctive nature like a dog that reveals what's going on here with the wizard. And then they all step by step, piece by piece, realize that this guy is an utter fraud.
And he does it. His performance is so great as he slowly gives up, you know.
Who are you?
Oh, I am the great and powerful
Wizard of Oz.
You are? I don't believe you.
No, I'm afraid it's true. There's no other wizard except me.
You humbug!
Yeah. And now I think this is Oz's greatest magic trick, really, which is that we should hate this guy.
Yeah.
And in the next three lines, we are going to totally accept him, despite what he did to Dorothy.
Yes, it's exactly so. I'm a humbug.
Oh, you're a very bad man.
Oh, no, my dear. I'm a very good man. I'm just a very bad wizard.
Which is not true.
Yeah.
He is not a very good man. We could like him.
Yeah.
He just sent Dorothy off to die. And he's been conning this whole city and country forever.
Well, what about the heart that you promised Tin Man? Well, and the courage that you promised Cowardly Lion?
Well, and Scarecrow's brain.
And now he just switches over.
Yeah.
Into now he's going to give the gifts.
Why, anybody can have a brain. That's a very mediocre commodity. Every pusillanimous creature that crawls on the earth or slinks through slimy seas has a brain.
He does love playing with language, man.
Mm-hmm.
And then now this is his gift. And as I said in the book, it is, look, you're already smart. You just don't have experience. You just have to learn. And then sort of with a pun, he fills his head with sand and needles so that he will be sharp. This is a very different thing.
Back where I come from, we have universities, seats of great learning, where men go to become great thinkers. And when they come out, they think deep thoughts, and with no more brains than you have. But they have one thing you haven't got, a diploma.
And he hands him a diploma, makes a speech with some Latin over him.
I hereby confer upon you the honorary degree of Ph.D.
Ph.D.?
That's Doctor of Thinkology.
And I'm sitting here going, okay, so the con man has given the Scarecrow a fake diploma.
Yes.
And he puts his finger to his temple and says, completely incorrectly,
sum of the square roots of any two sides of an isosceles triangle is equal to the square root of the remaining side.
That is not correct. It's not an isosceles triangle. It'd be a right triangle. This would be correct.
Ah, there you go.
And so to me, I love that, like, the con man has given him a fake diploma.
Yeah.
And now this is the first stupid thing that the Scarecrow says is when he has the fake diploma in his hand.
But he thinks he's smart.
But he thinks, no, but, and this is what, so I think these are terrible messages at the end of this movie.
What?
I do. Oh, wow. This is terrible. Well, like, I think the L. Frank Baum message of, like, you already are smart and you just have to learn through experience is a great message.
Okay.
The thing you're lacking is a fake diploma so that other people will think you're smart is not a good message.
Well, the thing you're lacking is a diploma. He never says it's a fake diploma.
Well, it is a fake diploma.
Well, if you think it's a fake diploma, I don't know if it's a fake diploma. There's no quantifiable way to prove it's a fake diploma.
Is there a universitatis commedium?
I don't know. I didn't live back then. I don't know what they had back then and what qualifies. It's more, but you know this, having been in the workforce, so many jobs won't even see you for an interview unless you have a diploma.
100%.
And it doesn't even matter what diploma it's in. I think there's currently a commercial running right now where the guy's like, oh, we can't hire you because you don't have a college diploma. And she's like, what was your diploma in? Dance. Oh, dance? But you're doing economics. Well, but I got a diploma. And it's like, well, no, that's actually not the way you should be able to get out of these things. So I think it's a bit of a commentary on this idea that you need to have a diploma in order to be considered intelligent, when in fact it isn't true. But I don't know what the thinking was in having him say something incorrectly. So
I think it was a mistake. Yeah. I mean, I don't think they intentionally had him say something incorrectly. I think they were not big on the Pythagorean equation when they were writing this script in 1938.
You are under the unfortunate delusion that simply because you run away from danger, you have no courage. You're confusing courage with wisdom. Back where I come from, there we have men who are called heroes. Once a year, they take their fortitude out of mothballs and parade it down the main street of the city. And they have no more courage than you have. But they have one thing that you haven't got, a medal.
And he gives them a medal. Again, it's the outward signs that this movie is concerned with.
Well, because it's a visual medium. I don't know. I think that's why they go that route. to show. And plus, it's for kids, right? So it's like
this. Look, it's the Wizard of Oz. It totally works. Everybody loves it. I'm just saying that if you look at the classic moral lessons in history,
yeah,
in general, the moral lesson is what you really need is a sign to prove to other people that you're brave. You know, that is not generally the right moral lesson.
That's what a medal is.
Yeah. It absolutely is. But yeah. The important thing is if you asked a hero and they said to them, hey, what was more important, this medal they put on your chest,
yeah,
or the actual thing you did to save the lives of the people? And they're like, the medal doesn't matter. That is my opinion.
Yeah, some of them do. Yeah.
Some of them do. And of course, the medals do matter. I'm not saying that someone who wins the Congressional Medal of Honor, that's not important. That's totally important. Kisses him on the cheeks. I like, again, Bert Lahr is always great.
Shucks, folks, I'm speechless.
As for you, my galvanized friend, you want a heart. You don't know how lucky you are not to have one. Hearts will never be practical until they can be made unbreakable.
That's great.
Right?
Yeah.
Back where I come from, there are men who do nothing all day but good deeds. They are called good deed doers.
Total Porky Pig moment. Porky Pig must predate The Wizard of Oz, doesn't he? I don't know if he does.
He's trying to be philanthropist, wasn't he? Or was he?
Philanthropist, totally. Yeah.
And their hearts are no bigger than yours, but they have one thing you haven't got, a testimonial.
And he hands him, you know, a heart necklace. And then says in these words of wisdom that I completely disagree with.
And remember, my sentimental friend, that a heart is not judged by how much you love, but by how much you are loved by others.
I think that the trying to get the world to love you is a terrible, terrible moral lesson. And spreading love is a good thing to do.
Hmm.
I think this is, you go ask any, you know, go look at Jesus. His message is not, you need to get other people to love you. Well, his message is you need to love other people.
Right, but I disagree with how you're interpreting that message. He's not saying go be loved by others. He's saying the worth comes from how much people love you. And the way people love you is if you do good things for people, if you help people out in life.
I'm totally good with that.
Yeah. I think that's the interpretation I've always gotten from that line. You know, but people might agree with you and see it in a different way. But I've always seen it as not about trying to get people to love you. It's about doing things that are good, and people will love you if you do things that are good. And they'll all show up at your funeral and they'll all speak about how great you were. You know?
Well, and regardless of whether or not anyone else agrees with my crazy opinions, I am not going to sit here and badmouth The Wizard of Oz any further. I've spoken my, we don't need to spend any more time on it. That's my weird reaction to it.
This isn't debating the point, but yes. Okay.
So they're all celebrating what they've gotten. They are all winning except Dorothy. Yeah.
What about Dorothy?
Yes, how about Dorothy?
Yeah, Dorothy next.
Yeah, Dorothy.
I don't think there's anything in that black bag for me.
Very wise of her to say that, by the way.
Yeah.
You force me into a cataclysmic decision. The only way to get Dorothy back to Kansas is for me to take her there myself.
And this is why we love the Wizard, because he is at the, you know, we kind of forget a bunch of the weird stuff he did before, but now he is, I am literally willing to change my life to do the right thing.
Well, and that's something you brought up earlier, which I think is a great point. It's like, how can we forgive him so quickly? But yet in society, we do this all the time. We do this. Look, I'm not going to get political, but wherever you side on the political side of things, Marjorie Taylor Greene, you could argue, said some of the most horrific stuff over the last 2 to 3 years, and some of the craziest accusations. But the second she starts to turn against Trump, all of a sudden everyone's like, well, she might be turning over a new leaf. Let's forgive everything she said. Let's accept her into the... So it's that kind of thing. We have that within our nature, especially if you're going to apologize for the way you were before. It's always that, there's always that caveat. You have to apologize for the things you said in the past. I think we're more willing to forgive people because we all make mistakes, or we all can get caught up in feeling grandiose. It happens in Wicked, right? Glinda says at the beginning of the movie of Wicked for Good, like, who could resist being beloved like this? But by the end, she realizes that that was empty to pursue that, and she wants to do something better with her life. You know, so we have that, but it is pretty fast in the movie. You
know? I mean, but it does work. I mean, this is one of the interesting things about the things that make one movie work are not the things that would make another movie work.
So true.
We can't shift gears this fast. If we were in the middle of the Social Network, yeah, we wouldn't just suddenly go, and now I think Mark Zuckerberg is awesome. Like, you can't shift those things that fast. But in this movie, you can. You know,
yeah, right. In Schindler's List, when Ralph Fiennes stopped shooting Jewish people for a little bit, I'm not going, wow, he's a good guy.
Well, and then we have this moment because she's like, well, how could you get him back to Kansas? And he goes,
oh, but are you a clever enough wizard to manage it?
Child, you cut me to the quick. I'm an old Kansas man myself, born and bred in the heart of the Western wilderness.
What's interesting about this to me is, to me, I go, oh, he kind of is Professor Marvell.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
As opposed to the other guys who are just, you know, doppelgangers or related to. But this is like, no, his backstory sounds real similar to that guy we already met.
One day, while performing spectacular feats of stratospheric skill never before attempted by civilized man, an unfortunate phenomena occurred. The balloon failed to return to the fair.
It did?
Weren't you frightened?
Frightened? You are talking to a man who has laughed in the face of death, sneered at doom, and chuckled at catastrophe. I was petrified.
I love jokes like that.
Yep, absolutely.
That's just the old school jokes. I love them. And he tells the story about how he got flown to Oz, and that when they saw him, they just assumed that he was a wizard.
Times being what they were, I accepted the job, retaining my balloon against the advent of a quick getaway.
So he's a con man.
Yes.
Who came in and completely just declared himself king of this world. And this is why Wicked makes so much sense, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Because in any way we should think about it, we should think of this as a bad guy, even though, yeah, we really like him.
100%.
So he's going to take Dorothy back to Kansas in the balloon, and we cut to the big ceremony where they're going to fly away. The balloon is in the middle of the set, surrounded by the citizens of Oz. He makes a big speech.
And I hereby decree that until what time, if any, that I return, the Scarecrow, by virtue of his highly superior brains, shall rule in my stead, assisted by the Tin Man, by virtue of his magnificent heart, and the Lion, by virtue of his courage. Obey them as you would me.
Very satisfying.
Yes.
This is also what happens in the book, until, of course, Ozma, the true ruler of Oz, finally returns to Emerald City and takes over as queen.
Oh, okay.
But while this is happening, Toto is distracted by a cat in the crowd, starts barking, runs out of the balloon. Dorothy chases him just as the rope somehow gets untied. The wizard flies off, calling back,
I can't come back. I don't know how it works. Goodbye, folks.
Goodbye. So he even conned them about being an established balloonist. He even conned them about that.
I really can't imagine a con man getting in charge of a country who really has totally incompetent, has no skills whatsoever. I can't imagine a thing like that happening.
That. Yeah. Toto giveth and Toto taketh away. Toto totally. Reveals the wizard, but then Toto get Dorothy out of the thing to ruin her ride home.
Toto seems to have figured out everything along the way. Because if Toto didn't do that, then she wouldn't be able to use the ruby slippers.
That's true.
If Toto didn't chase Elmira Gulch's cat... Well, and actually, this is still chasing a cat. Toto chasing cats is always a problem.
Stay with us then, Dorothy. We all love you. We don't want you to go.
Oh, that's very kind of you. But this could never be like Kansas. Annie M must have stopped wondering what happened to me by now. Oh, Scarecrow, what am I going to do?
Look. Here's someone who can help you.
And here comes Glinda.
Glinda, where the fuck have you been?
Oh, will you help me? Can you help me?
You don't need to be helped any longer. You've always had the power to go back to Kansas.
I have.
Then why didn't you tell her before?
Because she wouldn't have believed me. She had to learn it for herself.
You know what? She might have.
Well, first of all, there is the line that we pointed out where she says, these shoes must have some power.
Yeah.
Which implies that she might not have known that Dorothy had the power at the time and had to, Gandalf style, as we discussed, go off and research what the shoes could do. That's a possibility.
Good point.
One of our patrons, Adam McAllister, says that he thinks, because we had brought it up in the last part, does the witch know that the wizard is a con man? He thinks that she does, But he says the more important question is, does Glinda know if the wizard is a con man? Because if she does, why does she send Dorothy to a con man? No, you know, like, you know, and if she doesn't, if she's then she's really not very competent. And how does she know about all this stuff?
Yeah, I've never had a good feeling about Glinda at all from the beginning when I used to watch the film, because it occurred, if you think about it logically, and I was thinking logically at 10 years old, you know, like you go, well, why is she only showing up right when, like right at this, sure, right when the need is really big. But she's only shown up, what, two or three times in the whole movie, right at the beginning to send her down the yellow brick road, then to sprinkle some snow to wake them up in the poppies. And then at the end shows up to help her find her way back home and tell her, you had the power all along. Like, and not even trust her with the information until she went on this journey. So Glinda may be the person who wanted to get rid of that witch more than the wizard. The other witch more than the wizard, which is why, as you said, Steve, earlier, Wicked really smartly understands that the McGuire, who wrote the book, understood where to play within the parameters of the story and create his story, because there's a lot of room for like going, what the fuck, throughout this entire movie.
It's so funny when you read all the books, because there's also the witch of the good witch of the South. North and South have good witches, and East and West have bad. And then there's all the politics of all these different kingdoms run by all these things. And the great thing about all of it is that none of it particularly makes sense. And that's okay, because it's the Wizard of Oz, you know? Exactly. Like, we're here to have fun. You know, we're not here to make this all work perfectly.
Right.
But we do ask, has Dorothy learned the important lesson? And she goes,
I think that it wasn't enough just to want to see Uncle Henry and Auntie Em. And it's that if I ever go looking for my heart's desire again, I won't look any further than my own backyard. Because if it isn't there, I never really lost it to begin with. Is that right?
Such an interesting line, isn't it? And you have to think of when this film was made and the time. Because the message basically saying, you never need to leave home for anything that you need. It's everything you need is right here. You don't need to go to the big city. You don't need to get no learning. You don't need to get culturally more aware. You don't need to be exposed to other thought patterns and other ways of being. You stay right home and you stay exactly thinking the way we want you to think. Everything's here. Nothing you need is outside the home, you know? And so it's an interesting message, because it certainly was the prevailing mindset for a lot of people back then, you know?
I mean, it's a fundamentally conservative message. I don't mean that politically conservative. I mean, it's like, don't go out, you know, stay here, stay with what you know. Right. And what's weird about it to me, and I think this works perfectly, it's not a criticism, but what's interesting about this statement is that it really is in direct contradiction to the story we just went in. Because the story we just went on is Dorothy had to go on this adventure to appreciate the home.
Right.
Dorothy has grown because she did this thing.
Right.
You know, and so even though the message is the value of home, there's no place like home. The part of the story is, this is a classic hero's journey. I mean, this is as textbook. The person has to leave their time. They are challenged by people. They have new ideas. They meet new companions who teach them new lessons. They go through the valley of darkness, and they come out the other side and return to their home with new knowledge. It is classic Joseph Campbell hero's journey, you know.
But that's so easy. I should have thought of it for you.
I should have felt it in my heart.
No, she had to find it out for herself. Now those magic slippers will take you home in 2 seconds.
Oh, Toto 2?
Toto 2.
Now?
Whenever you wish.
And now we have to say goodbye, which strangely enough, we didn't really say goodbye when she was leaving the first time.
Yeah.
You know, and this is classic good filmmaking choice that doesn't exactly make sense, and this is the right way to do it. You don't say goodbye twice.
Goodbye, Tin Man. Oh, don't cross. You'll rust so dreadfully. Here's your oil can. Goodbye.
Now I know I've got the heart, because it's breaking.
Oh, great delivery, dude. Great delivery on that line.
It's perfect. It's perfect.
Goodbye, Lion. You know, I know it isn't right, but I'm going to miss the way you used to holler for help before you found your courage.
I would never have found it if it hadn't been for you.
Perfect. Perfect moment. Then she hugs the scarecrow and says,
I think I'll miss you most of all.
I'm just looking at the Tin Man going, I'm right here. Like, come on.
I know I'm made of tin, but I ain't made of tin.
Then close your eyes and tap your heels together 3 times. And think to yourself, there's no place like home. There's no place like home.
There's no place like home. There's no place like home.
We get that spiral line. The camera pushes in on her, and then the house falls, which I think is an interesting choice.
Yes.
We go back to Sepia, and now they are waking up Dorothy with a wet washcloth, and we still hear her muttering what she said, what we believe, in her dream.
There's no place like home.
No... Wake up, honey.
There's no place like home. There's no place like home. No.
Dorothy, dear. It's Aunt Em, darling.
Oh, Annie Em, it's you.
Yes, darling.
Hello there. Anybody home?
And there is Professor Marvell, like, right there at the window. Boy, good timing and a little invasion of privacy, Professor.
Yeah, exactly.
I just dropped by because I heard the little girl got caught in the big... Well, she seems all right now.
Yeah, she got quite a bump on the head. We kind of thought there for a minute she was going to leave us.
Oh.
But I did leave you, Uncle Henry. That's just the trouble. And I tried to get back for days and days.
There, lie quiet now. You just had a bad dream.
And now our three guys show up.
Remember me?
Your old pal, Hunk?
Oh.
Me? Hickory?
You couldn't forget my face, could you?
By the way, in the original script... there was a hint at a romance between Hunk and Dorothy.
Oh.
And at the end, he's saying goodbye to her because he's heading off to follow his dreams at agricultural college. A lot of good things got cut out of this movie.
But it wasn't a dream. It was a place. And you, and you, and you, and you were there.
Oh, sure.
But you couldn't have been, could you?
It's so funny. The whole it was a dream thing is just a lot to reckon with, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and also this moment mirrors the moment when she says, you guys look familiar to me, when she's in Oz, but you couldn't have, right? And all three of them say, well, I mean, Scarecrow and Tin Man both say, you know, no, because you weren't there when I was put up on the pole and you weren't there when I was being constructed. Right. So it's an interesting scene to hear what she's saying here now, which is you guys were all there, but you couldn't have been, could you? You
know. So, yeah. See, to me, it is so funny what my brain did as a kid, because my brain would not accept that it was just a dream.
Mm.
My brain was like, this is a parallel universe with there was a Piers Anthony book I read once or read many, many times where there were two parallel worlds, one that was magic and one that was science. And the same people occupied. So you had a doppelganger on the science world if you were in the magic world. Yeah. That's what I always, as a kid, I was like, Oz is real.
Yeah.
And sometimes through a dream or through other circumstances, you can go occupy Oz. And there's some connection between the worlds. But I just could not accept that this wonderful world that I had visited was just bull, that it was made up. I don't know. Like, do you feel betrayed? Did you as a kid feel betrayed that it was just a dream?
I've never really kind of sat with it and thought it out whether it was a dream or not. Because she was knocked out, right? So is that considered a dream if you have, you know, if you go on this kind of vision quest in essence while you're knocked out? Because I've always associated with dreams with sleeping, and I don't necessarily equate being knocked out with sleeping. Like, because she got hit on the head, right? They said she got bumped on the head. So I don't necessarily equate the two. So this is more of a vision. I see it as more of a vision. Yeah.
I can see that. But the adults are like, you know, saying what you say to a kid. Like, all of a sudden, we believe a lot of silly things. And Dorothy is insistent. And I think Judy Garland is great in this last sequence.
Well, we dream lots of silly things when we...
No, Aunt Em. This was a real, truly live place. And I remember that some of it wasn't very nice, but most of it was beautiful. But just the same, all I kept saying to everybody was, I want to go home. And they sent me home.
And they give her the indulgent smiles that you give a child.
Yes.
Doesn't anybody believe me?
Of course we believe you, Dorothy.
but anyway, Toto, we're home. Home. And this is my room. And you're all here. And I'm not going to leave here ever, ever again. Because I love you all. And, oh, Auntie M, there's no place like home.
It's the end of The Wizard of Oz.
I want to see their faces off camera when she says, and I'm never leaving. I'm staying here for the rest of my life.
We have our final question from board member Maria, who wants to know what happens to Toto, because Miss Gulch still has the warrant out to have him killed.
Oh, right.
And so Maria goes, unless, of course, Miss Gulch was killed in the cyclone, in which case, Toto gets away with it. Otherwise, we're going to have to go to the sheriff, and we're going to have to fight this thing to have Toto killed.
Yeah.
And maybe Auntie M and Uncle Henry, because they almost lost Dorothy, maybe now they're more willing to fight for her dog.
There was a great SNL sketch about what happens. I think we posted it on our Facebook one time, of what happens after It's a Wonderful Life is over.
Yes.
And the citizens go and find Potter, and they kick the shit out of Potter. So I think the same thing happens here, because we were much more, we were much more country justice back in the old days than we are now. And so I could totally see them getting together, going after Gulch and like getting that dog back. And if she tries any shit, they'll let her know what the hell's up, you know? And so I could see that happening 100%.
As we are winding down on shooting this movie, we discussed this before, but just a little bit more detail,
sure,
is over on the set of a little movie called Gone with the Wind, the director, George Cukor, and the star, Clark Gable, who were very good buddies, which is why Cukor was directing the movie, are not very good buddies as they're shooting. And basically, David O. Selznick says, I got to take Cukor off the picture. I need a go-to person to finish this movie. The most go-to person in Hollywood is Victor Fleming. And so Victor Fleming leaves The Wizard of Oz before it finishes shooting. And that is when King Vidor comes in and shoots all the sepia stuff, including the Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And when they ask him, he works about 2 to 3 weeks, which is a good chunk of time to work on a movie. And they say, basically, what do you want your credit to be? And he says, this is Victor's movie. Don't give me any credit.
That's great.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I thought so too.
I will say, directors take care of themselves. I don't know if they take care of actors and writers. Certainly the recent strikes left me with a bad taste in my mouth about the DGA. But they do take care of each other. And I've heard many, many stories of directors like championing each other to other executives or promoting each other. Yes, occasionally they'll, you know, try to take a job or try to get a job ahead of another director. For sure, that's the business. But most stories I hear are directors trying to help other directors and uplift other directors. So I'm not surprised.
So post-production, this is state-of-the-art special effects. I mean, we don't, you know, it's like there have always been special effects movies. You know, we tend to think like, oh, Star Wars is where. No, there have always been. And like just the tornado alone took them huge amounts of time to pull off. And we've already talked about some of the other special effects. The initial cut's 2 hours. As we said, they cut, you know, Ray Bolger's dance number, the Jitterbug number, the triumphant return to Emerald City. That Emerald City musical number cost $100,000 to stage. And they cut it because they said, we don't need this.
Right.
And as we mentioned, they wanted to cut Over the Rainbow, and fortunately that was stopped. I want to talk a little bit about marketing, because at the time we have to understand, like, this is the world of the studio system, and the studio system is a factory. And when you're in it, they have the system worked out from beginning to end, and you work for the studio to do what they want. So this movie was going to be released in August of 1939. Marketing started right at the beginning of the year with Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney, because they were paired together because they had made movies together, on a float at the Rose Bowl Parade to start advertising The Wizard of Oz. And then they put Judy and Mickey on a PR tour around the country, where they are doing 5 to 7 live shows a day, promoting their MGM musicals and promoting The Wizard of Oz. They're at the 1939 World's Fair with Mayor LaGuardia promoting The Wizard of Oz. It's just like, you do what the studio tells you to do. Okay, you're going to go here and you're going to do this show. Okay, I guess that's what I'm going to do. You know, the movie opens on August 10th, 1939 at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood. Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland did live shows before every single screening for all week for the week that it opened. Mickey Rooney had to go to do another movie. Judy Garland continued to play. And what would happen was this time it would be Ray Bolger to come who shows up to perform with her. Then it's Bert Lahr who shows up and perform with it. Day after day, she's doing the opening act before the movie.
Right.
Wow.
So at this time, 85 million Americans, that's 65% of the population, go to the movies at least once a week. There's just no way to understand the importance of movies. It's before TV, radio exists, but this is the main entertainment.
Oh, yeah.
And so at this year, 1939, is one of, if not the greatest movie year in Hollywood history.
Yeah, because here, one of the greatest years in Hollywood.
Yeah. Here, I'll give you a list of some of the movies that came out that year, many of which go on lists of great films. Mm-hmm. Wuthering Heights, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Golden Boy, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, Stagecoach, Of Mice and Men, Gunga Din, Ninotchka, Stanley and Livingston, Drums Along the Mohawk, Hounds of the Baskervilles, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and of course, Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah,
I mean, that is a remarkable list. And And so people are going to movies all the time, but there is a lot of competition. And two things conspired to have The Wizard of Oz actually not make money in its initial release, which I never knew. Like, it didn't make money for two reasons. One is there's a hell of a lot of competition.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just movies, and they have great movies coming in every week. So they pull Wizard of Oz fairly early from the theaters. But there is another reason that this movie did not make a ton of money, which is in August of 1939, 2 weeks after the movie premiered, Germany invaded Poland. And suddenly the world became very different and people weren't rushing out to see The Wizard of Oz.
Yep. Yep. Well, because you're distracted by other things. Right. Exactly.
Gone with the Wind, obviously, is not only the biggest movie of the year. Gone with the Wind was the biggest box office movie until it was beaten by another film we did 30 years later. We didn't do it 30 years later. It came out 30 years later, and that's The Sound of Music. But really, if you correct for inflation, Gone with the Wind is still the most successful movie of all time by far.
Wow.
You know, for how many people that came to see that film.
Don't tell those Marvel people. Or Avatar people. They get real mad. Yeah.
The Wizard of Oz had 5 nominations. It was nominated for art direction, score, song, outstanding production, which is best picture, and special effect. It won for score and for song, which was Over the Rainbow. It didn't win any of the others. They all went to Gone with the Wind. Victor Fleming was not even nominated for best director for Wizard of Oz because he was nominated for Gone with the Wind, which he won for. And then Mickey Rooney presents a special honorary Oscar for Judy Garland for her work in Wizard of Oz, which is pretty cool.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
The movie first aired on TV in 1956. At that time, 58% of America watched it.
Wow.
More than half the country, the whole country, watched The Wizard of Oz when it was airing. It's absolutely huge. And I know kids today cannot understand this idea of this movie that came on once a year. Mm-hmm. But this is a huge part of our childhood. We all waited for it. The whole family would sit down to watch it together. And then in the 60s, people started to get color TV. And, you know, because when it first came out in the 50s, the whole movie was black and white. So you didn't get that sepia or black and white into color moment. In the 60s, that starts to happen. Yeah. And this is arguably the most beloved movie in history. And it has spawned a whole bunch of stuff. There's a 1972 movie, Journey Back to Oz.
Oh, yeah.
And then in 1978, there is The Wiz, based on the musical of the same name. I haven't watched in a while. I think that movie got kind of poo-pooed by culture. I remember it being super cool.
First of all, it's directed by Sidney Lumet. That's stick into your mind. And it has recently gotten a Criterion 4K release. And I personally have always loved the movie. I don't think it's as strong as Wizard of Oz, but the songs and the characters are amazing. And I like their version of Ease On Down the Road. I like that more than Follow the Yellow Brick Road. I think it's a better song. And then the song with Slide Some Oil Right to Me, the Nipsey Russell song for the Tin Man stuff is amazing. And even the Scarecrow Crow with Michael Jackson singing with the crows, You Can't Win, great stuff. And I like the Nipsey Russell, I'm sorry, the Cowardly Lion stuff as well. And then the villain, the Wicked Witch, she has that big song at the end. So it's not as strong as The Wizard of Oz, but I think it has grown in people's estimation over the years as people have revisited. And there's a better appreciation for the movie as well. I don't think Sidney Lumet was the right person to direct a musical, a black musical like this, but he's an incredible director. So, you know, what are you going to say no to Sidney Lumet at the time? No, but I think there's a better version down the road, maybe from a black filmmaker like Ryan Coogler or someone else who wants to take another stab at remaking The Wiz. I'd love to see it. I'd love to see it.
My memory is that it was a very inventive movie. Mm-hmm. I actually might watch it again. I'm kind of curious about it. And I think I've said this on the show before, but everyone could take this for exactly what it is, which is that my almost entirely white junior high school did The Wiz as its musical in eighth grade. There was one African-American who played Dorothy.
Yeah.
She was great. And two people who are listening to this right now, Matt Grieber and Matt Rosen, my old friends, who are both supporters of the show on Patreon.
Yeah.
But I think Matt Grieber was the Cowardly Lion, and I think Matt might have been the Scarecrow or maybe the Tin Man. I'm not 100% sure.
Right.
But we were all in the – all of us little suburban white kids were in The Wiz.
It's a good way to appreciate it.
Joel
Schumacher wrote the screenplay for this. Let that sink.
Really?
Joel Schumacher and Sidney Lumet. It's based on the William F. Brown musical, who he wrote, obviously based on The Wizard of Oz. But yes, it was Joel Schumacher who is credited as the screenplay writer for The Wiz. Yes.
Well, and something I found out years later listening to some podcast or something is that in the Soviet Union, there was an entirely Soviet version of The Wiz. Of The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, okay.
Someone found the story and basically translated it. I think the writer's name is Volokov.
Okay.
Translated it into a girl named Ellie Smith and her dog Totoshka. And there were books and there were movies and there were all these things. Wow. And all these people growing up in the Soviet Union for decades loved this native Russian beloved story and had no idea that there was this American thing that it was based on.
Right. Because we weren't doing cultural exchanges at the time for a long time. So no surprise at all. And the stories are similar, though. I mean, it fits, right? The idea, I'm sure the Russian people are a conservative people. This idea of you should stay at home, right? You should be at home.
Sure.
Everything you need is right here at the home. Why do you need to go anywhere else, right? So there's a lot of similarities in American and Russian points of views when you look at conservative points of views, with this particular situation.
And I wouldn't say that The Wizard of Oz is as directly influential as Tolkien is to fantasy. Mm. I think, there is a whole world of fantasy that couldn't possibly exist without Tolkien.
Right. Right.
I don't think The Wizard of Oz is quite that. But I do think that it is deeply embedded into our culture in all of these ways.
Yep.
And in particular, the quest and just L. Frank Baum's method of animation. I think if you turn on children's television or 80 years of children's television, L. Frank Baum is in there and The Wizard of Oz is in there. You know what I mean?
Yep. 100%.
But it is tremendously influential in all sorts of ways. We already talked about Friends of Dorothy and its influence on the gay community. There's also another Wizard of Oz thing that I would like to ask you about. Okay. And this actually comes from another of our patrons, Tom, who writes, speaking of fun conspiracies, when was the first time you heard about syncing up Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon with The Wizard of Oz? And have either of you ever tried it, either high or sober? And what do you think of the claims of synchronization with the film and the album? John, have you ever heard of this Pink Floyd thing about The Wizard of Oz?
I've been hearing that since high school in the 80s, I think, or my early years in college, my first trip through college. But I've never done it.
Oh, really?
Because I've never been I'm not really the biggest Pink Floyd person. Like Pink Floyd and Grateful Dead, I objectively know they're great and people love them, but I don't necessarily gravitate to their music. Even though I do love Comfortably Numb as I've gotten older, it's one of my favorite songs ever. I'm not really a Pink Floyd guy, so I wouldn't have thought to do it. I've never owned Dark Side of the Moon. I've never even heard Dark Side of the Moon. So, yeah.
I mean, you've heard a bunch of the songs. They're big songs on it.
Are they?
That you've heard. Money.
I've heard Money.
There are a bunch. You know a bunch of the songs.
Okay.
But so I first heard about this in college. Mm-hmm. And went, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then I was at a, you know, it's someone's dorm where they were doing it. And I sat down to watch a couple of minutes sober. Then in film school, someone was going to do it. And I did watch it and I was high. And what's weird, what was weird about it is because at this point, I had already learned one of my favorite film school terms. And this film school term ruins doing it. Doesn't ruin it, but the term which I've shared before is psychoacoustic coincidence.
Yeah.
And what psychoacoustic coincidence is that sometimes when you put a piece of music or some kinds of audio up against some video, things will magically sync up. And sometimes it can be amazing. And having, because as an editor, see, I was already an editor when I did this first time, watched Dark Side of the Moon with Wizard of Oz, is that I had already experienced this thing all the time. You throw music at some video, at some film, and then magic happens. And I've already told the stories about using Peter Gabriel's Passion, Last Temptation of Christ soundtrack, or using the Akira soundtrack or the Mission soundtrack. And I would just throw music at something and you would go, oh my God, it added all this meaning and experience and stuff. And that is exact. It really does happen. There are moments, if you ever do this, where you will go, and it works particularly well if you are high, where a thing will happen exactly on the second and you'll go, that was amazing. And it is a coincidence. It just happens to match up. And it's, you know, your brain will make it make sense, you know, because that's how our brains work with film. But it is pretty fun.
Cool.
And that, and of course, that brings us to, you know, the most important update on the Oz story, which is, of course, Wicked, which debuts in 2003 and has been running on Broadway ever since and toured the world. And now is, of course, the subject of two massive, massively successful films.
Yeah. Yeah, we've reviewed our Wicked for Good. It's up for those who might have missed it. It's up for as a short for our patrons. So if you're a patron, you can listen to it. Or if you join our patron, a Patreon, you can listen to it. Our thoughts on, and it's like 30 minutes, our conversation on that.
Yeah, no, it's about 35 minutes. We had a long talk. I guess I'll give my final thoughts first.
Okay.
Which is, Oz was really important to me growing up. This was the gateway drug to being a reader. Really, yeah. I would say just being a reader in general, and fantasy reader in particular, it sunk up with my love of comic books and what would become my love of science fiction and fantasy and superheroes and stuff like that. I think it is a uniquely American story. It does not draw off of the traditional fantasy elements like Tolkien does of traditional stories. It has that American feel. And I think, you know, what's so interesting about the movie is that I cannot judge this film objectively because this film is part of my childhood. There's nothing, you know, and it goes into this weird place of there are things in the film that I pointed out were like, I don't really think this makes sense. I think the wizard, when you think about him, is a terrible person. I don't understand why Glinda is doing this. And yet this movie works in this wonderful way. And it really, it's the world, it's the performances, it's the look. It's Somewhere Over the Rainbow. It's the amazing performance from Judy Garland. It's the incredible three friends that she gets to meet with. It's the silliness. And of course, it's Margaret Hamilton, man. I mean, I think that one of the most iconic performances in film history. And this is a part, this movie is a cultural icon in a way that I don't, maybe not any, I'm thinking about the top 10 AFI films, Citizen Kane, Lawrence of Arabia, Godfather. Maybe Godfather is an icon in the same way. But I don't think anything lives with all of humanity the way that The Wizard of Oz does. I don't think there's any movie that quite has that mass appeal, that quite has so much connection to us in our childhood, and that continue. So one of the things my son said when I took him to see Wicked for Good is he said, it's not as good as The Wizard of Oz. He, a 14-year-old kid living in 2025, loves The Wizard of Oz as much as I do. That's the most important final thought.
Yeah, I don't have much more to add to that. I mean, I think you said it so well, Steve. Usually I have my own final thoughts, but there's not much that I would cross that doesn't feel the same, that I don't feel the same way about. So I would say this, it's a film that I don't always run to watch, and I've always appreciated for its effect on me as a kid. But I had kind of pushed myself away from the movie for a long time. So rewatching it and analyzing it for our show, it helped me to reappreciate its greatness, especially the timeless themes and messages of the movie, the found family, the importance of found family, and also the amazing technical expertise of the people involved in making this movie. Because as great as the story is, as great as the performances are, you have to set it against a backdrop that is very memorable and touching and timeless, and at times jaw-dropping. And so I find that to be very clear, something comes through very clean for me on The Wizard of Oz. And so that's one of the reasons why I still think it's an amazing film. I love the film. Judy Garland, right at the beginning of this incredible stardom that she's about to walk into, and sadly, some of the tragedy involved in that as well. But the incredible performers who never went on to be as great in anything else as they were in The Wizard of Oz, and that speaks volumes about how magical this film is that it brought all these actors together. You mentioned Margaret Hamill, but Frank Morgan as well as the wizard, these iconic performances, bringing to life these iconic characters inside of an iconic story. It's a fantastic film. And I think you're 100% right, Steve. Very unique. It's a one-of-one film. And those are very rare in the history of film, for sure.
So that's our thoughts on The Wizard of Oz. Of course, we've already been hearing a bunch of your thoughts on our Facebook. Yeah. It's The Cinephiles, Cine_Files on Twitter, The Cinephiles Podcast on Instagram. Great to see your comments there. Of course, a wonderful place to join the conversation is on patreon.com/TheCinephiles, where you can even join it as we have in our monthly meeting on our advisory board and help us chart the future of The Cinephiles. If you want to buy or stream The Wizard of Oz, along with every other film we've ever reviewed, that's on cinephiles.net. Your comments and reviews are certainly welcome on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to reach me, it's at SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram. John, how would folks reach you?
You can always reach me on all social media at The Rocha Says, R-O-C-H-A. And then you can head on over to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/JohnRochaSays. Just crossed 40,000 subscribers, march into 50. Would love for you all to come aboard and see all the great content we have over there, reactions, reviews, and conversations on all our shows, including the Geek Buddies, about things that are going on in the world of entertainment.
And I think that's it for this week. We'll be back next week with another great film right here on The Cinephiles.